Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This year's college graduates face a job market that is fundamentally changing. Manufacturing and service jobs are going abroad. Employers focus Durham tight on bottom lines, layoffs, par for the course. Along with all the grads eager to don suits and ties, there are those who don't want anything to do with the rat race. Time, they think, is on their side. They'll try out a job or two before making any long-term career moves and figure out whether they want to follow the money or their muse. One new survey says accountants, actuaries, and financial planners now have the best jobs, and cowboys and dancers the worst. Well, maybe. In this hour, we're going to look at which fields are hot, which fields are not, and what jobs might still be around in the next decade and more. Tonight on Point, good jobs, bad jobs, the best careers now, and what to do with your life. You can join the conversation. Are you searching for a career, a first career, a second, a third? And what are your criteria for choosing? Do you have a career you love or hate? And what's your advice now to a young graduate choosing a path? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from San Francisco is Poe Bronson, author of the best-selling book, What Should I Do With My Life? The True Story of People Who Answered the Ultimate Question. Poe Bronson, good to have you. Welcome back to On Point.
Oh, it's nice to be back. Thanks very much.
Also with us from Claremont, California, is Carl Martellino, director of the Career Development Office at Pomona College. Mr. Martellino, thank you for joining us.
Good evening. My pleasure.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. There's a career. Jack, good to have you along.
Thank you. Good to be here. Hello to our guests.
Carl Martellino, first to you, if I may. What's the job market look like for the kids coming out of your college, out of college in general this year?
Well, it's certainly looking quite a bit better. I mean, certainly when we look back to 1999 and 1998 were really anomaly boom years, but certainly this year is the best year since the downturn. Things are looking quite good.
I'm reading here about a survey out of Michigan State, a national survey saying employees expect to hire 20% more graduates this year than last, but they say that after all the years where they weren't hiring, it's going to take several years of that kind of increase to mop up the folks who are still waiting for work.
Absolutely, and I think one of the differences we see too is that the number of students who are going directly into the job market is shifting a little bit. In fact, students are taking time off and looking for the jobs maybe 3 months or 6 months after they graduate, rather than going directly from undergraduate into the job market.
That's not exactly a giant sabbatical, 3 months or 6 months. Where do you see your students going? I mean, you've got a liberal arts college there, so I don't know if it's fully representative. But what do you know? What do you hear?
Well, what I've been seeing a lot is there is a shift. I mean, when we're looking at our latest survey, we had about close to two-thirds of the class that went directly into employment or to a fellowship or to graduate or professional school. And then the other 33 to 35%, they're taking time out. Maybe they're going back home. They're moving in with friends. They're doing some travel. And they just want to take their time. When I talk with them, they're saying things like that they're looking a lot more for an extraordinary life rather than sort of just jumping into a career that they really don't know that much about yet.
And how do you interpret that? Is that a she Pomona view of the world, or do you think that's a typical view among graduates in the class of 2005 nationally?
I think nationally that's becoming more and more typical. When I talk to other colleagues both on the East Coast and on the West Coast, I'm hearing that a little bit more these days than I have in the past.
We're seeing college placement officers saying demand is strongest for accounting and finance managers. Now, of course, with all the new regulations on business, we know a lot of accountants required. Are you seeing patterns or bulges in the demand profile there in different fields?
I am. There certainly is a rise in the demand. Again, you are seeing the accounting coming up. You're seeing areas within finance. The consulting areas are coming back up again, certainly, and investment banking seems to still be doing well and better than it has been. I think where the shift is coming is more from the student side and what they prefer and what their preferences are and what they're looking at. And that's diminished a little bit in those areas, not tremendously, but I've seen some diminish in not going after those accounting jobs or those finance jobs and wanting to do something just a little bit more unique.
And how do you advise students when you look out on the global economy? I can't tell from your voice how old you are, but are you giving students different advice today than a career counselor might have 10 or 20 years ago?
Well, I've been in the business for about a little over 15 years, and there is somewhat of a shift in what's going on. I think right now students are looking, and the advice that we give is more to focus on a next step, not trying to plan out your career for 10 years or 20 years or 30 years, but really putting yourself in a situation where, in fact, opportunities are going to develop and come to you, and that you'll sort of take that time to figure out exactly what it is that you're going to enjoy and like. And it's not necessarily that aha moment that, you know, at 22 years old or the day after you graduate or even at 23 or 24 that you're going to know, well, this is my career for life.
So be ready to kind of roll with it for a while. And yet, of course, you know, you've got to pay the rent at some point. I'm looking here. The National Association of Colleges and Employers says salaries in most disciplines up modestly this year, up 3.9% for accounting graduates to $43,809 average starting salary. Business administration and management degrees, average offer $39,448. Well, of course, it's not everything is about money, though it's a piece of the picture. Poe Bronson, you've written and thought a lot about this and pretty recently, yet the economy and the sort of market for employees keeps changing out there. What's your latest thought on how new graduates and people who are moving careers, you know, changing careers later in life, how they ought to be thinking about what they're facing?
Well, as you mentioned, and Carl mentioned, with students striving for that extraordinary life, and interestingly, the roller coaster quality to the economy has not made students really more risk averse, and not made them more so go more for the secure jobs.
Yeah.
It's actually made them sort of just generally be daunted and not want to play the game and aspire to something greater, and that's important. And I think one of the things that they're realizing finally is that for a long time we had this premise that you could sort of look into this box of chocolates, even though it had its lid on it, and even though each chocolate was coated with this, you know, brown candy, but somehow,
so you didn't know what was inside, right?
Somehow by discerning your own internal skills, you'd be able to wave your hands over that box of chocolates and pick the right one for you.
Yeah.
It's this premise that you can, in the absence of experience, know or intuit the right choice for you. And that's actually absurd. I mean, we try our best, and we should try, but we shouldn't expect that that's actually going to work. And so understanding that it's going to be a series of steps, you're going to make some mistakes, that's okay. You need to put yourself in a position where you can find opportunities. And then I actually tell them, because I do want to know about what makes life extraordinary, is, again, it's a fallacy to think there's somehow an intrinsic fit that's going to turn you on. There's some of that, but it's overrated. Just insurance agents, for instance, some of them love it, some of them hate it. Some of them are so grateful that they're there for Mrs. Smith with the check when her husband died, and some feel like they're making a bunch of money for some corrupt CEOs in the middle of the country. There's no list of honorable careers, and I tell people that you need to develop skills, and then at a certain point in your career, learn to employ those skills to serve what you believe in. And that's when you'll really find the kind of fulfillment and satisfaction that you're actually looking for. It doesn't come because there's just this perfect fit, like I'm born to be a writer. I'm happy being a writer because I'm writing things that help people. I'm happy being a writer because I connect to others and I'm making a contribution to society. And those are the feelings people are looking for. So the hardest thing is not getting those skills. The hardest thing is learning to make that transition later when you're going to employ those skills to serve what you believe in.
Jack Beatty, there's the call to look for a job you believe in. Of course, some kind of sound romantic and like they might tease belief out of us, and others sound, you know, like they just are jobs that need to be done. Yet we've got this changing economy, different attitudes on the parts of employers toward employees, very different benefits packages and profiles as people look down the road. Put yourself in the shoes of a graduate in 2005. Jack, what do you see out there?
Oh, well, I'd be just very anxious about my future just because of these big changes in the economy. And at the risk of sounding like an old, well, I won't say that, but an old man, my advice would be live toward your obituary. You know, when you read obituaries, as I do now a lot, what strikes you is they have a narrative. And the narrative usually is that this person has made a difference in the lives of other people, either through his or her profession, a teacher, a doctor, policeman, fireman, or through community volunteering, that the person has has done things that are non-economic in motivation and in satisfaction. And I think the reason obituaries, at least of ordinary people, have that character is because, of course, these are the most satisfying things people can do. And as it happens, professions that deal with people's lives are jobs that can't be sent to China. And so I would think that just for reasons of satisfaction, we are moral beings, and we do take pleasure from doing the right thing. And I think that both for satisfaction and for job security, I would think of professions that allow people to do that.
Carl Martellino, we've just got you for another minute here. There's some very high-toned aspirations. Pope Bronson says, aspire to something greater. Jack says, live toward your obituary. You describe a lot of investment bankers, investment banking interest as well. I mean, do you see your students aiming for that obituary profile or for some bank?
Well, the interesting thing is I actually do see our students. You know, Pomona College has a very highly talented pool of students, and going back to what Poe was saying, they actually aren't so anxious about the future, aren't so anxious about the economy. They do want to go, in fact, in the direction of what's going to make them happy, what's going to be their definition of extraordinary, and in fact, what is going to make a difference, both in their lives and how it's going to affect others. So there really has been a downtrend in terms of the number of students going for the investment banking, the finance jobs. Certainly there is a subset of students who still have a strong interest in those areas, but as a general trend, I'm seeing a lot more towards the nonprofits, towards the arts, more what you would expect from a liberal arts education, but historically, definitely a change.
Always hard to predict how humans are going to respond to changing circumstances. Carl Martellino at Pomona College, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Pope Bronson, Jack Beatty, stand by. We're talking tonight about good jobs, bad jobs, and the best careers now. You can join us. How do you judge whether a job is good or bad these days? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about good jobs, bad jobs, and the best careers now, about hot fields and cold fields, and what to do with your life. Poe Bronson joins us tonight from San Francisco. He's author of the best-selling book, What Should I Do With My Life? Jack Beatty's with us. You can join us as well. Are you searching for a career? What are your criteria? Or is the whole idea of a career history? And do you already have a career you love or hate? What's your advice to a young graduate choosing a path? What job will last in our fluid economy, our global economy? Are you shopping for a career that won't be sent to China? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, speaking of good jobs and bad jobs, we're joined right now from Titusville, New Jersey, by Tony Lee. Tony is publisher of CareerJournal.com, the Wall Street Journal's career site. He's co-editor of the journal's Jobs Rated Almanac, which lists the best and worst jobs in America. Tony Lee, thanks for being with us tonight.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So I'm not sure it's obvious to me how to rate the best and worst jobs. How do you do it?
Well, we use primarily six criteria, and the six in no particular order are income, you know, how much money people make, hiring outlook, does it look like there'll be strong demand for that job for the foreseeable future, job security, is it likely that the person will be laid off or have their job outsourced to another country, the physical demands, how hard is this job, you know, what's the likelihood you might get hurt on the job. The work environment, are you in a cushy office with air conditioning, or are you, you know, fighting fires in the back of a fire truck? And finally, the stress level, you know, how much anxiety is there in your job?
So you make some assumptions here. For example, that a person would rather be in a dry, cool cubicle than on the back of a fire truck, for example.
Yeah, we do. And the assumptions, you know, we're the first to admit that, look, you know, this is a general guide, and it's not meant to be the end-all. There are some extremely happy cowboys and garbage collectors and lumberjacks, some of our worst-rated jobs out there. But when looking at it analytically, looking at it, you know, with these numbers, they tend to fall to the bottom of our list.
Okay. So give us, I mean, I'm looking at your list here. Maybe you'll give it to us. It comes out with a high priority on kind of a cubicle, white-collar jobs where a nice manicure would last for days.
Something like that. Among the jobs that do very well, actuary, biologist, financial planner, software engineer and computer systems analyst, website managers, statisticians. Those tend to be bank officers. Those tend to be the jobs that fare the best in this study.
Actuary, right up near the top of your results for best job in America. You better define what an actuary is.
Yeah, good question. An actuary tends to define risk, usually for insurance companies. However, they work for many other types of companies. And if you talk to an actuary, they say that it's a very challenging job. You need some mathematical skills. They're the ones that determine how long someone is likely to live. Or in a healthcare coverage, for example, if a company offers, you know, one type of coverage versus another, what the likely cost to the company will be over that period of time.
So this sounds about as deep in the green eye shade as you can get. This is math all day long and maybe filing papers with the government, stuff like that.
Not too much filing, but lots of math and lots of, there's actually a lot of analysis. So if you talk to an actuary, they say it's very much like putting together puzzles all day, if you like to put together puzzles, it's a dream job.
But you won't break a physical sweat, most likely. A lot of job security, pretty good pay. Now, on your worst list, you've got construction worker, cowboy, dancer, fisherman, garbage collector, iron worker, lumberjack, roofer, seaman, welder. I mean, just about anything that used to have a union attached to it, that
yeah.
You call the worst jobs in America.
To some extent. I mean, you know, it depends on commercial fishermen. You know, everyone's seen Perfect Storm, and they can relate to why that's a very dangerous job. Cowboy, you know, is one that seems very glamorous, but in fact, you know, they earn on average about $18,000 a year. They tend to sleep in a sleeping bag on the ground in a tent, whether it's 10 degrees or 110 degrees. And in fact, the cowboys we interviewed said that, you know, one of the big problems is they get bitten a lot by their horses, by their cows, by snakes. So they make it through the year without getting bitten. It's a good year.
Indeed, though the one that you profiled here says he thinks he's got the best job in America. He makes $12,000 and he says he still can't believe he gets paid a penny for it. He loves it so much.
Absolutely. And again, you know, there's always an exception to the rule. And if you've always dreamed to be a cowboy, then don't let us dissuade you. Please go ride the open plain and enjoy yourself.
Best and worst. Poe Bronson, you hear the criteria here, and I wonder what you think of it. Income, stress, physical demands, hiring outlook, job security, work environment, and we come up with accountants and actuaries and bank officers and financial planners. Are you on board with this set of criteria?
Well, the normal scaling we get at this time of year is just about growth numbers. And I think Tony's doing the right idea, which is let's look at more factors than just which careers are going to grow, which ones are going to shrink. Let's look at satisfaction in some way. There, you know, in my book, what I do about, there's a welder, you know, there's a lumberjack, there's a fisherman, so and a construction worker, so. Again, I think that the intent is right, and I think that Tony himself and you, it's self-apparent of how it's sorting itself out.
Yeah.
It's not for me to criticize. I think the intention is right. As for whether these meet up with what people want, do they want income? Do they want, you know, growth and security? Do they not want to get hurt? Do they want a good work environment? Do they want less low stress? Yeah, those are the right things that people want. You know, we might want to tweak this a little bit, but it's the right idea to be looking for more than just, say, income and job outlook.
Right. You put stress and physical demands and job security, work environment in there.
I would put, you know, one of the main things is just work hours, you know.
Yeah.
People want to have time for their families, and people should hear mythic stories. One of the things, if you're a young graduate, it's very easy to fool yourself and pretend, well, I'm going to be a bank officer, but I'm not going to be the kind of bank officer that works 80 hours a week. Well, bank officers don't work 80 hours a week, but they do work 60.
Yeah.
And 60 might be way too much for a lot of people, and you can fool yourself. So I think that, you know, we can tweak the factors, but we're headed in the right direction if this is what we're going to do.
Tony Lee, your actuary is very focused on that. He says, nobody's putting in 80-hour weeks in my business, maybe 45 in a long week, but he likes all that downtime. That's his.
Yeah, and that's, you know, we actually did consider work-life balance. We considered travel, you know, if there's extensive travel involved. They were lesser criteria that kind of worked into some of the others, but I think Poe's hitting it right on the head. And actually, you know, Poe, what you said in some of your books that I'm a big admirer of is, you know, you have to kind of look for your own self-interest, too, and what really motivates you. I mean, what this is really all about is, you know, what gets me excited in the morning? You know, the worst time of the week for far too many people is Sunday night because they have such, you know, terrible anxiety about going to work the next morning. If you feel good about getting up and going to your job as a welder because you really love what you do, then ignore this. It's irrelevant to you.
Which shows what a topsy-turvy world it is. I mean, that's on the worst jobs in America list, as you put it, as you describe it. But if you love it, what's better?
That's really the bottom line. I mean, the people who tend to get the most benefit out of this, and we've done this, you know, quite a few times over the years, kind of fall into two groups. Mm-hmm. One are the high school students to recent college graduates who, you know, are afraid they're getting pushed into a career they don't really like or
yep.
don't really want, and
mm-hmm.
so they use this to do a little analysis to figure out what else is out there.
Mm-hmm.
The second group are the mid-career changers, and sadly, there are way too many people out there who've been working for 15 or 20 or 25 years who really don't like what they do. You know, they headed into a path because it was the available job, or their parents pushed them, or their spouse pushed them, whatever.
And they're looking for a good new place to go.
You know, they're facing retirement in 15 or 20 years, and they're thinking, is this it? Is this going to be my career? I want to go do something that's a lot more fulfilling. And so they look at something like this and say, you know, I have the skills to be a financial planner, but I've never really thought about it, you know, and maybe it motivates them to look into it.
Tony, I know we have to let you go. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Tony Lee, publisher of CareerJournal.com at the Wall Street Journal's career site and co-editor of the journal's Jobs Rated Almanac. You can see the best and list jobs in America by their reckoning at CareerJournal.com. Let's take a call. Carolyn's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Carolyn. What do you think?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is what I think. I'm not really a mid-career changer, but I went into professional school as a veterinarian at 29 years old, and I love my job. It's the greatest job in the whole world. The job satisfaction is great, but this is the bummer.
okay.
I'm $75,000 in debt and almost 40 years old, and now, of course, I have a baby and a mortgage to pay. And so I always say to myself that the advice I'd give my little boy is that it's great to find what your passion is, but try and do it a little bit earlier than later because it gets tough.
But Carolyn, let me ask you about that. I mean, to be a veterinarian, you can't get through that course and be a whole lot younger than 29. It's not like you dawdled.
No. I started late. I went to veterinary school at 29, and then I actually specialized in
veterinary
medicine.
Oh, you went at 29. I see. I thought you got out. What's your specialty, Carolyn?
Emergency and critical care.
And are you for large animals or are you pets?
No, I'm for small animals, and so I actually did a total of 8 years of after undergraduate training, starting at 29. So it was it's been a long road, but it's worth it as far as the career goes. But financially, and you know, I get paid a good salary, but financially, you know, things start happening when you're 40 years old. Like life goes on, and I'm paying a student loan debt that's half of my mortgage.
So are you saying, wow, are you saying, Carolyn, that we can hear how much you love it, but as much as you love it, if you had it to do over again, you would run the numbers first and maybe do something you love less because you'd have fewer financial demands, fewer student loans?
You know what? You know, that's a hard question. I don't know if that's true or not. I might think of going into human medicine where the salaries were a little bit higher, though, because I think the jobs are very similar. But, yeah, I mean, I would have calculated a little bit more, maybe, had I realized that I was going to be disinvolved. But I love it, and I don't regret it. But I would have, maybe, if I knew then what I know now, I would have thought about it a little bit.
Poe, what do you say to Carolyn? Can you offer her some solace here?
Let me ask her one question
yes.
first, because she seemed to be saying the first time she was speaking that she would tell someone, just, if you want to do it, don't wait. And that's what she seemed to count to say. And did you wait? Did you think, I want to do this, but I shouldn't, or I couldn't, or it's, I should do real medicine or something? Did you push your passion away for 8 years or something?
Carolyn?
I did. I think I did. I dawdled a little bit. I wasn't sure if I could do it. I wasn't sure if I wanted to make the time commitment. You know, I know that the passion was there, and I worked in several jobs leading up to it, but I never made the commitment.
So what do you say, Poe?
Well, people need to know regarding what jobs pay, that people do survive at a lot of levels, economic levels and income levels in our economy. And a lot of people don't survive at lower levels. But you need to learn to work in a field where you're passionate, but you can also afford it. And starting earlier is good. Learning how to live on less is just as very important as well, and learning to have the kind of lifestyle that fits the kind of work that the kind of income that you're going to get from your work. And as Carolyn says, you can have a baby and be 40 and have $75,000 in debt, and it's going to be hard. But I think it's going to work out. You sound excited about it, and I think that's going to be in your work. And, you know, you'll get that debt paid, and I bet you it's going to be fine.
Carolyn, we wish you luck there. Thanks very much for your call. Let's take another call. Peter is on the line from Canton, Massachusetts. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Thank you. It's a great show. I'm a mid-career person who's probably had 9 different careers, always following my passion, following what I loved, and I'm still haven't found it. I said I've kind of tasted all the chocolates in the box. They tasted great for a while, and then then they went sour on me. I've always followed things I like, but I'm so desperately looking for something that's going to really connect and stay.
And you haven't found it with 9 careers. How old are you, Peter?
37. I mean, I've got time, but I am looking at that, you know, what's around the corner. I want to start a family. I've got the house payment now. You know, see the challenges that people are facing in terms of health care and retirement. I'm told again and again I just need to do my own thing and be my own boss.
Yeah.
But there's a leap there that in unsettled times with health care costs and otherwise, you know, it's...
No, I hear you loud and clear. Peter, stick with us here. Jack Beattie, what do you hear? Peter is 37 years old. He's had 9 careers, and he's still looking for the love of his life on the career front.
Well, he's an Emersonian character. He's on a quest to realize himself, and he just hasn't found it. And I bet one of the reasons that's true of so many of us, is that, you know, most work in America is organized along Taylorist lines. That is, the lines of Frederick Lewis Taylor. Winslow Taylor laid down a century ago, basically the time and motion study man who divided all work.
Efficiency.
Efficiency. And, you know, people don't come in that. We don't come in efficiency. We come with scope. And to the list of criteria, I would put scope. Does this job allow me to use the faculties that I have as a human being? Or when I come into this workplace, do I have to put aside 99% of what I've got in order to just earn a living? And if a job gives you a chance to have scope, that's really a recipe for happiness. Someone asked John Kennedy, "Are you a happy man?" And he said, "Yes." And he answered, "Why?" And he said, "Well, because as Aristotle said, that happiness consists of the exercise of the faculties along the lines of excellence." Mm. Well, all the faculties, I think, is the key thing there, and as many of them as the job will tap. Boy, it seems to me that's the way to go.
Peter, what about it? Have you moved on time after time because you didn't have room to fully spread your wings in these jobs, that they were narrowing you down?
I believe that is so much the case. I couldn't agree more with Tom. And part of the problem is when you do these changes, I was told even 10 years ago by career counselors, people value multiple careers and people you can be pick things up quick and transfer your skills. I believe in that. But when you get along, even at 37, you come into a new career, you somewhat start back at the lower part, and then you realize I'm not using, you know, the 90% of my mind because I'm pigeonholed into something, and that's what does make me want to yearn to get on.
And we can hear you at the same time, though, kind of yearning for a career home. Poe Bronson, what do you make of this story?
I'm wondering, he says he's had friends tell him you ought to be your own boss, and like Jack says, finding somewhere you can use up a lot more of your skills. You know, you don't have, there's somewhere in between, which is just smaller company versions of what you're doing, where you have a good organization, a moral organization, that you believe in what they're doing, and it's just because it's smaller, they're stressed, and they need all your skills. You know, they might need you to sweep the floor at night, or they might need you to program the computer, even that's not in your job description.
Wear a lot of hats.
A lot of people thrive on that.
Mm-hmm. Might be it. Early stage companies. Peter, may I just ask you, are you married?
I am.
So despite the fact you sort of got a commitment allergy on the career front, but not the marriage front? Or have you had 7 marriages?
Right, absolutely not. I mean, the marriage front is strong and secure. But I think the multiple hat wearing is what satiates me. It's just a matter of finding it in the right small organization. And I have actually gone to the nonprofit world to find that commitment, or to find that fulfillment.
Well, I'll tell you, brother, I've been on that startup front, and that will keep you busy. If you're looking to wear a lot of hats, as Poe says, that might be a place to go. Thanks a lot for calling, Peter.
Great show.
Poe Bronson, Jack Beatty, stand by. We've got to take a short break here. We are talking tonight about good jobs, bad jobs, and the best careers now, about hot fields, cold fields, and what you want to do with your life. You can join the conversation tonight. What is most important to you? Is it income, security, creative engagement? Can you have it all? And what do you think right now, 2005, what is hot? What's sexy as a career? What's the new plastics? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about careers, about hot fields and cold fields, and what to do with your life. You can join the conversation tonight. How do you judge today whether a job, a career, is good or bad? And is your career following your heart or your head or both? If you had it to do over again, would you do it differently? What makes a great career these days? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our Jack Beatty is with us tonight. Poe Bronson joins us from San Francisco. His novels include Bombardiers and The First 20 Million is Always the Hardest. His latest book is What Should I Do with My Life? The True Story of People Who Answered the Ultimate Question. Right now, we're joined from Titusville, New Jersey. From New York, by Colleen Kinder. She graduated from college in 2003 and will be starting a graduate degree in writing this fall. She is author of Delaying the Real World, a 20-something's guide to seeking adventure. Colleen Kinder, thanks for being with us tonight.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So we're talking about careers and when to plunge in and how to plunge in, how hard and fast to plunge in. You might have heard our caller Carolyn from Milwaukee saying she wishes she would have gotten on the path to being a veterinarian a little sooner so she didn't have all these school debts when she's 40 years old and getting into family life. But what's your advice to new graduates, Colleen?
Well, my view is that a lot of 22-year-olds don't necessarily know what they want to do with their entire lives, but they do know what they're passionate about. And for some, that might mean being a cowboy or working on a sailboat or teaching English overseas. And Delaying the Real World, the book says, go for it. Why not? Fresh out of college is the prime time to do it.
Did you take your own advice, Colleen?
I did take my own advice. I spent a year in Cuba volunteering on a public service fellowship.
And what did you get out of it that you wouldn't have, got from going straight into your writing program there?
Oh, geez, where do I begin? Well, first of all, I got foreign language skills. I'm fluent in Spanish, and I wrapped my mind around one of the most confusing countries in the world, the most perplexing.
Yeah.
And I think I got job skills as well because I worked on magazine pieces, and I wrote a book while I was down there, and just really had some time to be independent and think about what I wanted.
Jack Beatty, I've got to say, I took Colleen's path, did a fair amount of wandering first, and it was absolutely wonderful. I wouldn't trade it for anything now. But is that still a fiscally sound path, Jack?
It sounds great to me. I mean, it's always, the moratorium is always seems hazardous. People say the clock is ticking. You've got to get in there. But to start, as Colleen does, with what, at least have had that experience of really doing something you like, that can be a touchstone later on. Maybe you can go into a career and say, well, now I can retire a little early and get back to what I really like to do.
Come full circle. And Poe, what do you say? You advising Carolyn in her position, she might have dived in earlier and been better off financially. But here Colleen's saying, wait a minute, go out and kick up your heels.
Well, if you can. I didn't have that choice. I started work in sixth grade, and I never had the opportunity to stop.
Yeah.
But I did my own version, which is I was more like Peter. I mean, I had 9 jobs by the time I was 27 years old.
Mm-hmm.
9 post-college jobs. I was always working, almost never took a vacation, but I was trying a lot of things,
mm-hmm.
paying the bills and sending money home and paying off student debt. But nevertheless feeling like I was having experiences. And I think that I tell people you have to learn to both get what you love and learn to love what you get. Mm. And learning to love what you get is a tricky thing. It requires maturity, and it also helps to have perspective. And having danced around a little bit, whether it's in Cuba or whether it's, you know, job to job, if it gives you some of that perspective where you can ultimately say, you know, I shouldn't expect for too much. I should learn to adopt some of these things and learn that there's going to be a pace to life. It's not all going to happen right away. Mm. That's probably ultimately a good thing. And it's tricky. There's that old story of three bricklayers on break, and one guy asks the others, why are you doing this? And one guy says, I'm doing it for the wages.
Yeah.
And the next guy says, I'm doing it for the wife and kids. And the third guy says, well, I'm helping to build a cathedral. And he looks up, and that's what they're building,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And that's a guy who's learned to love what he's got.
There's the big vision he's got.
And that's not an easy value to achieve. I mean, you can't just force kids to learn to love what they get. Like, I'm not saying I told you so. I really mean it's part of maturity to learn to appreciate some things. And the journeys we make today do ultimately help us ultimately gain some perspective. And I'll bet you that Peter, you know, who we spoke to before with his 9 careers, he's going to have learned a lot because he's bounced around.
Colleen, is that your advice? I mean, you know, I worked hard and early in life, but was lucky. I was a Yale kid like you, and had a fellowship after college. It's lovely, but of course, a lot of people are not going to have that option. So, is this kind of elite advice you're giving, or is there a working class version of your lovely fellowship in Cuba?
Not at all. I think that there are a million ways that you can actually have quote unquote a real job that puts you in a challenging context, like a foreign country, or, you know, an outdoor adventure company, or, you know, I have people who worked on cruise ships in delaying the real world. I have people who started up charter schools in the U.S., really the whole gamut. And I think that no one's really talking here about taking a year off. It really is a year on, following your passion and letting that be your guide. And there are a lot of ways to make it financially feasible.
Of course, you know where the U.S. Army would like people to plant their boots in that year off, or two.
Right.
Sounds like that may not be at the top of your table of contents. Colleen Kinder, author of Delaying the Real World, A 20-Something's Guide to Seeking Adventure, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Marty is calling from in the Bronx in New York. Hi, Marty.
Hi. I've always found that when I, whatever it was I chose to do, I loved it. And I'm like a lot of your callers. I moved from job to job, and I'm currently in my 50s, and I just finished a 6-year professional training program, which I absolutely adored every second of, and I'm now looking for a new job.
Well, that's fantastic. I love your enthusiasm. What was the training program, Marty?
I'm going to be clergy. I am ordained clergy.
An ordained clergy, and you picked that up when you were in your late 40s or early 50s.
Well, what happened was every single career I've had seems to have kind of fed into the next one, but I don't think that I was aware of it when I looked forward. I said to your screener, it only made sense when I looked back, because I started life as an actress, and then I became a freelance storyteller, and then I worked in arts and education, and then I worked in arts in a not-for-profit that was a Jewish not-for-profit involved with intergenerational programs.
Yeah.
And I was always adding skills. I wasn't always adding money, but I was always adding skills to my basket.
And I'm curious that you came around to the clergy. I mean, that is a choice that I've seen a pattern of a certain kind of person making it about your age in life. How did you come to that one? Did you look back over all the others and say, you know, I was always kind of a shaman here?
Well, you know, I think part of it is I'm a cantor. I'm a chazan, a cantor. And I think part
in the synagogue.
Of it is that I really loved being able to use my presentational skills and those skills. But I think the thing that was really important for me was that the way that you were using it and the reason that you were using it changed over the years.
I love it. Marty, thanks so much for your call. Jack, here's a story of a woman who looks back and says, in retrospect, it all makes sense, even if it didn't exactly as she was surging into it.
She has the sense of destiny. you know, life is lived forward but understood backwards. And looking back, she says, my gosh, it all was making for this moment. What a great way to feel that nothing was wasted.
It is a great way. And Poe, ending up as a woman of the cloth here, am I wrong, or is there a kind of a profile of seeker? Who ends up there?
There's a story in my book of a lawyer who becomes a minister and several other people who experimented with that. And absolutely right, as Jack said, the Emersonian figure, and we've heard from a lot of seekers tonight. And I hope that more than anything, what this hour can kind of talk about is just that is, you know, one of life's great journeys. It's one of the great frontiers we have left, is this journey within to reconcile the life around us and the world around us with what's in our heart. And we all want to get it over with, and we all just want to find that thing, you know, when we're 22
right,
years old.
Right.
But really, kind of as Mardia feels, it's really nice to arrive at that after you've paid your dues and fought and struggled.
Yeah.
And you get a lot more out of it because of that. So I don't think we should just, you know, go to a career counselor and nail it at 21. We might be missing something.
There's something really beautiful about the work in progress. I mean, that combined career is something like maybe the cathedral your bricklayer is building. You know, you can have a vision of the whole as a kind of work of art. Ron's calling from Abrams, Wisconsin. Hi, Ron. You're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to comment. I think a lot of people are unhappy with their lives and their jobs nowadays. Mostly because they don't live within their means.
Mm.
They dig themselves in a hole,
yep.
And they get unhappy with life and what they're doing. I've been doing upholstery work for almost 50 years.
Upholstering furniture, Ron?
Yes.
And how has it suited you?
Well, it's suited me well. I have not made multitudes of money, but I've gotten along, and I've been happy with what I've done. I've made beautiful furniture for people for almost 50 years, and I don't think too many people have stuck at a job for 50 years.
I love it. 50 years is a long time. Are you still doing it, Ron?
I'm still doing it. I'm 69 years old, and I did retire, semi-retire, when I was 62, and a couple years later, somebody got my name and talked me into coming to work for part-time again.
And when you get into the workshop with the nails between your teeth and a good piece of fabric in your hands, do you get into a zone? Is it bliss for you, upholstering? Is it just a good, familiar career, like a love you've had a long time?
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't have stuck at it if it wasn't a love that I've had for a long time. I just enjoy working with fabrics. Actually, what I started out wanting to do was being a woodworker.
Yeah.
And I couldn't find a job at that time when I got out of service. I took this under the GI Bill and ended up being an upholsterer, and I've stuck with it through thick and thin. I've had some ups and downs, but stuck with it, and I've made a fair living out of it.
Mm.
But I've enjoyed what I've done, and I've made beautiful furniture for other people and myself. And I've probably gone through almost every kind of furniture there is.
I can believe it. It's a beautiful story. Jack Beatty, you know, this brings to mind for me, I spent a number of years in Japan, and it's a country where people really devote themselves to their work. And the way that work turns around and gives back to you, if you really devote yourself to it, whatever it is. I mean, Ron loves upholstering, and you can hear the satisfaction in those 50 years, even if it's not a titan of industry. What does he care?
What indeed, and what titan of industry can say, I made beautiful things?
Well, a few, we hope.
Well, you know, I mean, the satisfaction of the artisan, the maker, that is a, you know, all from the Greeks on, that has always been a sort of image of human fulfillment, and we forget about that. The carpenter, the joiner, the furniture maker, the finisher, people who really create things with their hands, that's a very satisfying way to spend your life, it seems to me.
Poe Bronson, so much manufacturing going abroad. Do you still feel the confidence in young people that they can get into a career like Ron's? Now, granted, custom upholstery is probably a pretty good local thing, but are people still working with their hands, or are they giving up on that?
No, they are, and you're right. I mean, we have this divergent economy where large swaths of cheap products are being manufactured all the world over, but the artisan trades and the number of people being employed in the artisan level, where they're really seeking not just a job but mastery and letting mastery be a philosophy that guides and fulfills their life, regardless really of that they get how much they get paid or how many customers they have or what their resume looks like or whether they get to wear a big suit and work downtown. And that's actually growing significantly and really in a boom these years. And I think that the technology combined with the global economy has and the money has created a sort of a secondary economy for elite goods.
Yeah, I love that mastery that pays back in satisfaction and also in this economy probably pays fairly well.
That's right, yeah, or can quite, and turns into small businesses that become big businesses and eventually move those jobs abroad.
Let's get one more call here. Susan's calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi, Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, good to have you.
I work as a personal chef in Boston, and currently my husband and I have decided to move from our beautiful house in Watertown, about 1,200 square feet, into a 500 square foot apartment in Cambridge just because you know, I love working as a chef, and my husband is completely supportive of what I do, and we're just doing it because we're doing what we have to do to get by.
So you're shaping your living environment around the what you can make at doing what you love.
Absolutely, and we have no regrets. My husband's a musician, so this is something that he, you know, is on board with as well. I mean, it's not like we're not making a ton of money, but we both are extremely happy with what we're doing. Your guests have hit on a number of topics. I mean, everything rings true as far as, you know, having to pay for health insurance and working with our hands. Everything that you guys have talked about this evening is something that is very close to both of us.
Susan, and I hear you there, and I hear your dog as well. You going to have room for Bowser in the new place?
Well, that was my dog.
Oh, was it yours, Bo? Okay,
yeah.
Sorry. Okay, that's a California dog barking.
And so she's going to have to move into this small place with us. But, you know, it's just something we have to do, and we're both very happy to do it. I mean, you know, we wish we could make more money, but in the end, realistically, you know, there's so much talk about health care and what's going to happen in the end as far as retiring, you know.
Right.
We just talked about Ron from Milwaukee.
Yeah, in Wisconsin, upholstering this. So you better do what you can love for a long, long time. Susan, we're almost out of time here, but thank you very much for your call. Paul Bronson, we've just got a minute left here. Final thoughts from you on this moment in the economy. Do people have to look at their career search differently?
Than in the past?
Yeah, than in the past.
Yeah, because even if you said, I'm going to throw out all this self-actualization stuff, I'm just going to go get a job that's going to pay me, and I'm going to accept it, I'm going to do what my boss tells me, and I'm going to live at it for the next 30 years, there are no jobs like that anymore.
So you'd better self-actualize.
You're going to get laid off.
Right.
And your spouse is going to move, and you're going to have to move.
Yeah.
It's a mobile economy, and you have to protect yourself, and you better find something else in it, because that kind of security is not a choice anymore.
Jack, that's a wonderful thought, a kind of inversion of what you might expect. You can't hunker down. You've got to become, look for that self-actualizing in your job, because it may be most of what you end up with.
It could well, and you know, when we hear these voices of Marta, Peter, Ron, and Susan, my gosh, the enthusiasm and the sort of growth that they sound, you can hear it. It's like an ad for precisely what Poe was saying.
Well, it's a beautiful thing. Poe Bronson, we're out of time. We'll have to have you back sometime. It's always great to talk with you. Thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
Thanks very much to be with you guys tonight.
Poe Bronson, author of What Should I Do With My Life? And Jack Beatty, thank you so much for being on board.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.